Hello there and good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. You can follow me on Twitter at JimboTalks, as we will talk this evening about guns, bad, evil guns, killer machines, nasty, horrible, should be banned. Not really. That's not our view, and it's certainly not the view of our guest, John Lott, who is a Crime Prevention Research Center president, economist, and author. And good evening, John.
Great to talk to you again, Jim.
Yes, indeed. You know, what I just said, of course, sounded like an unbelievable caricature of gun critics, but I don't know that I was that far off the target.
Well, I mean, it can be an emotional issue for many people. I guess my concern is that, I understand where people see something bad happens, and they think that if they can merely get rid of guns, then the bad thing won't happen. What they don't seem to understand many times is that when you go try to do things like ban guns or pass other types of regulations, you have to worry that if you primarily are affecting law-abiding good citizens, if they're the ones who obey a ban, for example, then you may make it easier for the bad guys to go and commit the types of crimes that they were committing.
We're going to be talking about a variety of articles that John has written. He is a prolific debater on this subject and also a writer on this subject. And one thing that you passed along to me that I find rather interesting would be how gun sales are doing under President Trump. Now, if I'm not mistaken, gun sales took a surge toward the end of last year as people contemplated the possibility of a President Hillary Clinton, a phrase that still doesn't really roll off the tongue. But have gun sales continued at record levels?
Well, they've been at, it depends on what month, but they've either been at record levels or close to it. So in November and December last year, even after the election, they were still at all-time highs. In January, February, and March, they weren't at record levels, but they were at the second highest levels ever recorded for those months. And again in May, we had record sales for ever occurring for May. Now, there are other indications that are somewhat surprising because, as you indicate, a lot of people thought the sales had been high just because of Hillary Clinton's possibility of being elected. But you look at concealed handgun permits in state after state that I have had the data for, where you can break it down both before and after the election, you find increases in the number of concealed handgun permits. You know, it's, again, people thought that those would be declining after the election, and yet they've continued to go up. What's been interesting has been kind of the changing demographics of who's been getting the permits. You've seen much bigger increases in women and minorities getting permits after the election. I mean, that's been a trend that we've been seeing for the last 6 or 7 years, that you've seen a big increase in permits, but primarily for women and primarily for blacks, but that's even kind of accelerated.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right. 1-866-50-JIMBO, our number, 1-866-505-4626. Let's talk a bit about gun control advocates. One of their principal calls, gun-free campuses. And you raise a very interesting point. Would you post a sign announcing that your home is a gun-free zone? Well, no. Obviously, the most diehard opponent of guns would not put up a sign that says, victim here, come on in, would they?
Right. No, I mean, I don't know how many people I've debated over the decades, but one thing that you just see time after time is that when asked would they be willing to put up such a sign, they say no, and I think it's for the reason that you say, that they just don't even think it would be credible to the audience for them to go and say that they would put up a sign like that. You know, we see gun control advocates like Michael Bloomberg or the staff at his group Everytown. They have armed bodyguards. You have vociferous people like Rosie O'Donnell or the former mayor, Richard Daley. You know, they would have armed bodyguards. And the question is why? They must believe that there's a benefit to themselves from having guns to be able to go and protect themselves. And that's fine. I'm glad that they believe that. The thing is, they're not the ones who are most at danger of having violent crime being committed against them. The type of people that are most likely to be victims are the ones that Mayor Daley, for example, or Michael Bloomberg would be disarming. It's basically poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. You go and impose large fees or leave it up to the discretion of local authorities who's going to be able to get a permit like in New York City. And, you know, you may see some very wealthy, politically well-connected individuals who will go and get a permit to be able to carry a concealed handgun. But, you know, your small business owner in Harlem or, let's say, just a mother who's having to take care of her kids by herself, she's not going to be able to go and get a permit. She's not going to afford it. And even if she could, she's not going to be granted it.
So they're not opposed to guns. They're opposed to you and me having guns.
Right. Well, I guess the good people, the ones who deserve it, the special people, should be able to be protected. It's just that, and again, that's fine. I'm glad that they recognize the benefits for themselves. But again, they're not the ones who are most likely to be victims of violent crime.
Yeah. Now, a professor at the University of Kansas, Jacob Dorman, has resigned because of his university's concealed carry policies. Tell us about Jacob Dorman at the University of Kansas.
Right. Well, I mean, he, like many other professors at the University of Kansas or other universities around the country which have allowed people to have permanent concealed handguns on their college campuses, has decided that he's going to go to another university because in order to protest the policy that's there. What's kind of amazing to me, I mean, when he made that announcement, it got national coverage on a lot of media. But the amazing thing to me is there's over 2,000 professors at the University of Kansas, and he's the only one. This bill that was passed more than a couple of years ago is finally going into effect on July 1st this year. And there's this big difference between kind of the horrible consequences that liberal academics have been claiming for these laws and the big gap between their words and their actions. I mean, if they really believe that this is going to be the end of the world, so to speak, you would think that they would be leaving in droves, not one professor out of 2,600 faculty members. And you see the same thing in other university systems. The University of Texas system has over 20,000 professors. Their law went into effect last August. Again, they had a couple year in advance notice before it was going to go into effect. And yet they've had two professors, one who is already retired, and so I'm not really sure how much he counts, and one other professor. You'd think out of over 20,000 professors, you'd have more than two that you could possibly attach to that. It's more than just that. I mean, they make claims about how they couldn't retain professors when these laws would get passed, or that they wouldn't be able to hire people, or the students wouldn't be going to the schools that are there, and none of those things have happened.
1-866-50-JIMBO, our number, 1-866-50-5426. Now, another article that our guest John Lott has written, and I'll just read the first portion of it and let him flesh this out. When it comes to voting, Democrats see free ID cards as too burdensome on the poor, but there's no hesitation to impose fees, expensive training requirements, ID requirements, and onerous background checks on prospective gun owners. Tell us more.
Right. Well, you know, I am sympathetic to making sure that people are going to be able to vote who want to vote. The problem is why that logic doesn't apply to other things that we deem as important for people, such as the ability for them to go and defend themselves. So Texas just passed a law reducing the fees for getting a permanent concealed handgun from $140 to $40. The Republicans pretty much voted unanimously in favor of the reduction. Yet if you left it up to the Democrats in the state House there in the state Senate to decide, the bill would have gone nowhere. It would have been soundly defeated. And you see that in other places. When Colorado a few years ago passed its background checks on private transfer of guns, I had been called up by some state legislators there, and they asked me what amendment I would put up. And I suggested having an amendment that would exempt people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax on transferring guns. With the exception of two pro-gun Democrats in the state House, every other Democrat voted against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay the new state tax. And I guess the question would be, how many taxes can you think of where Democrats will fight tooth and nail against exempting people below the poverty level from having to pay? And we see this time after time after, you know, you're in D.C. area. If after the 2008 Supreme Court decision that struck down D.C.'s ban on handguns, the D.C. City Council there passed fees and requirements that, according to the Washington Post, cost over $800 for people to satisfy the requirements. Well, who do they think they're stopping from buying guns? I mean, it's not wealthy individuals that they're stopping. And why is it that they want to impose the restrictions in such a way? I mean, it's one thing to go and say, we want to make sure people have a need for it. I mean, one can talk about how objectively those rules are put in place. But it's another thing just to impose high taxes and high fees, which you know are going to disarm the most vulnerable people. Again, poor blacks, poor minorities who live in high crime areas, whether it be New York or whether it be in Washington, D.C.
1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. 1-866-505-4626. And our guest is John Lott. He is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. And you can also follow him at John R. Lott Jr. on Twitter, JohnRLottJr. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number. We come back and take a look at the gun control debate, which certainly is unabated. Back in just a moment. Glad you're with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show as we talk with John Lott. He is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. We're taking a look at some of the issues that are popping up in the never-ending gun control debate. And we take a call from Sharon in Crane, Missouri. Hello, Sharon.
Hello, Jim. Mr. Lott, I want to thank you, sir, for all of the work that you have done to help preserve the Second Amendment. You know, ever since Concord and Lexington, the government of one kind or another has been trying to keep guns away from people. And now it seems to be this so-called elite, the ones who think I'm better than you are, I deserve more than you do, I am more important than you are. They have no problems justifying their rights to protection and security. But us peons and peasants down here in the real world, I guess we just don't have any right to expect safety or being able to protect our families or protect our lives. And I think the only way that we're ever going to get this changed is if people just vote out these people that keep saying, you know, guns are bad. It is not guns. It is the people that use them.
Fair enough.
Pure and simple.
Your thoughts on what Sharon has to say, John?
Right. Well, what has motivated me and what's been behind my research isn't the Second Amendment per se. It's been what makes people safer or not. And, you know, the comments that she was making about people being able to protect themselves, you know, that's been what I've been trying to measure over these years, to try to figure out what the net effect of gun ownership is, because one can surely think of bad things that happen, but you know, it's not whether we can save one life. The question is, what's the net effect? What's going to make people overall the safest? You know, the last comment that you made, I guess that would take some difference with, and that is it's important to recognize that guns do make it easier for bad things to happen. When you say, you know, guns don't kill people in a sense, it's people who are responsible. People are responsible, but certain weapons do make it easier for people to go and do harm. The issue is, though, those same aspects of guns make it easier for people to be able to go and defend themselves, particularly vulnerable people, particularly people like women and the elderly, people who are relatively weaker physically. The gun has a real equalizing effect there to make it so that people, you know, young males who are most likely to do the violent crimes can be balanced off. Because otherwise, how would somebody who's maybe in their 80s or 70s or a woman who maybe weighs 120 pounds deal with a guy who's going to be 200 pounds?
1-866-50-JIMBO. All right, other things that John Lott has put together. A very interesting little study that you put forth just last month. And I'll read the title of this article, and then you, again, fill it in. At the top, it almost sounds like you're dismissing this. Murder isn't a nationwide problem. But that's not what John is saying at all. Why don't you explain exactly what you mean by that?
Well, murder is a problem per se. The point is, though, it's very heavily concentrated in tiny areas within the United States. You have 54% of the counties in the United States have no murders in any given year. 69% of the counties have at most one murder in any given year. And, you know, on the other side, you have over half the murders concentrated in just 2% of the counties. And if you...
Now that's worth repeating. For those who weren't paying attention, over half the murders in this country are concentrated where?
In 2% of the counties. That's 60 counties out of over 3,140 counties account for over half the murders. And the thing is, if you look at what we call murder maps, kind of a map of where the murders occur in those 60 counties, they're usually very heavily concentrated even within those counties. You'll find areas like Los Angeles, you know, the western half of Los Angeles, there's like almost no murders that occur. They're all in kind of the Watts area or the eastern part of the county that's there. Very few in the northern part, very few in the, almost none in the western part of the county. You look at places like Indianapolis. The northern half of the county has almost no murders that occur in it. And anything outside the Beltway has essentially no murders that occur. We know time after time where these murders occur. And the thing is, if anything, they're even less concentrated than they used to be. If you look at the period from 1977 to 2000, on average, 73% of the counties in any given year had zero murders. You had like 2% of the counties there account for almost two-thirds of the murders that had occurred.
Wow. We're going to come back and talk some more. John Lott is our guest, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. CrimeResearch.org is the website. Our number, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Back in a moment. Glad you're with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Our guest is John Lott. He is one of the nation's acknowledged experts on gun control issues. His website is crimeresearch.org. And we talked to Billy in Mount Pleasant, Texas. Hello, Billy.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Fine, thank you.
Doing great.
I just got a quick question. You know, the government has put so many limits on the guns, but one of the things I'm wondering about is, I understand certain crimes, you know, like a convicted felon, et cetera, can't own a gun. But they take a DWI or so many traffic tickets or so many of this or that or the other, and they turn it into a felon, and you can't own a gun. How is that, and why is that?
All right, your thoughts about the definition of other law transgressions, John, that would constitute a fair basis for denying gun ownership?
Sure. Well, as the caller says, there are certain things that seem obvious. If somebody goes and commits murder or rapes or some other violent crime like a robbery, one might suspect that those people could be dangerous to do those types of crimes in the future, and there may be good reason to prevent them from having weapons, or at least make it a little bit more difficult. But on the other hand, there are plenty of crimes that you can commit that seem to have nothing to do with violence. I mean, one can go and talk about insider trading, for example, or something else that one can go and say is wrong and that you disapprove of. But you really don't get the same information about whether the person is a physical danger to others or might be, simply because they've committed a lot of different types of crimes that are there. And one wonders whether the point of these types of penalties is simply to reduce the number of people that own guns as opposed to actually dealing with crime per se. One of the things that you see is that in many states, when people go to the governor and ask for a pardon, they're supposed to list reasons why they want to have a pardon. And in many states, when people request a pardon, the number one reason that they give is to be able to go and own guns. It isn't to be able to go and vote or to do other things. It's because after they've been convicted, their income's pretty low. They may live in relatively high crime areas. Even some of the people who engaged in violent crimes before will live in those high crime areas. And they're concerned about the ability to go and protect themselves. You know, you see big changes since the 2000 election in terms of people who can vote. There's been a big push to allow people with violent felonies. Somebody could go and have raped four times, but in a number of states now, they're going to be able to go and vote, whereas before the concern was, well, if somebody's done that type of violent crime to somebody else, maybe we don't want them involved in public policy decisions that could be relevant to the crime that they committed. And yet the same people who want to let violent felons who committed murder or robbery or rape be able to go and vote, see no problem with that, would oppose letting someone who had a crime that had nothing to do with violence being able to go and have a gun to protect themselves.
Yeah, I can see any number of restrictions you might put on Bernie Madoff, maybe like a five-day waiting period to get a checkbook, but I'm not sure that gun ownership would be one of those. To James in Arlington, Texas. Hello, James.
Yes, Mr. Lott.
Yes.
I was wondering, have you ever looked into the requirements for the 1792 Militia Act? The act that required men of military service age to own their own weapon?
Right. Well, I mean, I've looked at it some, but just so you know, I'm not a historian. I'm an economist, PhD economist by training, and I kind of deal with numbers that we can measure, you know, and the changes that we can see. There wasn't a lot of data that I can use for the types of studies that I do back in the 1700s. But what tiny bit I do know about that is that the law that you're talking about did explicitly say that those individuals who were able-bodied had to be able to provide their own weapons in order to serve in the militia. The one thing about that act, though, is that it didn't actually impose any penalties on the states that didn't enact those types of rules for their militias. So, you know, did it require them? Yeah. But, again, I'm not a historian, and, you know, there are probably better people you can go and ask about those things.
All right. Thank you, James. 1-866-650 Jimbo. We go to Tom in Utica, New York.
Hello. Greetings from up here in Remington land. We're about 10 miles down the road from America's oldest gun maker. Since 1996, I haven't called in to Jimbo, but back in the United We Stand America days with Ross Perot, but having you on the air is really encouraging. I'd like, if you would please, Mr. Lott, Jim, to tell the nation about the study from Yale University School of Law and University of Adelaide on the effects of the Australia gun ban. And you might want to have a comment or two about your opinions on the final cut of your Katie Couric interview.
Okay. Well, the study they're referring to was actually done by myself and somebody else. It was done when I was at Yale, and you know, a lot of people have claimed that the gun buyback that they had in 1996 and 97 reduced, you know, firearm homicides and other types of bad incidences. What you have to understand is that firearm homicides and firearm suicides, for example, were falling for about 15 years prior to the buyback, and they continued to fall after the buyback, but at an even slower rate than they were beforehand. The way almost everybody kind of measures the impact of this is just to look at the before and after averages. And, you know, if you have something that's falling over the whole time period, you could pick any year, and the after average is going to be before the before average. We see this in lots of things. So, for example, you look at automobile deaths. From 1920, when we started collecting this data, deaths per mile driven have fallen virtually every year consistently. And so when people go and evaluate something like the gun or the car safety rules that you had in the mid-1960s, they really, you know, they could have picked 1950 or 1930. You still would have gotten the after average being below the before year average. And so you really need to look at things more closely, like whether it was falling at a faster or a slower rate. And often when you find this, you get quite different results, as you do in the gun debate, when you're looking at the data for Australia. And I think a lot of the claims thus are very misleading.
More to come, 1-866-50-JIMBO, our number. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad you're with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show as John Lott of CrimeResearch.org is our guest. Here's Bernie in Kennewick, Washington. Hello.
Good evening, gentlemen. John, I have a little bit of a problem with your analogy or your statistics, rather, of gun deaths in a few little counties. However, most gun crimes do not result in death, and I wonder if your statistic shows gun crimes are different that don't result in death than the ones that you show that do result in death.
Right. Well, murders are the most concentrated, but if you look at other crimes like rape is also very concentrated. If you want to get a good idea across the different types of violent crimes, I think it's chapter 2 or 3 in my book, More Guns, Less Crime, from the University of Chicago Press, kind of breaks it down and shows you pretty much for violent crimes as a whole, they tend to be very concentrated. Now, when you get to something like aggravated assault, you're going to see that pretty much spread across the whole country. But even with that, I can't remember the exact percentage, but you're going to find something like, you know, mid-30% range of the counties with no aggravated assaults even.
Okay. But would that show crimes that involve the use of a gun without death?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can break it down in different ways. You can look at aggravated assault with and without a gun, with and without some other type of weapon. You can look at robbery with and without a gun. Rapes, the FBI doesn't break down by whether a gun was involved or not. And you can look at homicides, murders, whether or not they involved a gun or not. But you pretty much see, not only for the overall categories, but even when you break it down by whether a weapon was involved, that violent crimes with a weapon occur overwhelmingly in a tiny part of the country. And it's largely related to gangs, or in particular drug gangs, and either directly or indirectly.
All right, thanks, Bernie. Appreciate your call. 1-866-50-JIMBO. Now, let's talk a bit about the Concealed Carry Reciprocity Act. What is it, and how close is it to being the law?
Well, right now, if you have a concealed carry permit, it depends on what state you're from, but it's likely that many other states, maybe most of the states, will recognize your permit, but not all the states will. And the reciprocity bill would try to make concealed carry permits more analogous to a driver's license. If you get a driver's license in Florida, you can drive to California or Maine or any other state in the country, and they will recognize your permit. You'll have to obey the individual state driving laws that you're in, but you're still going to be able to go and drive your car. And I get emails all the time from truck drivers, for example, that drive across the country, and they may have valuable cargo, and they may be worried about being robbed. But, you know, if they have to drive through a state like Illinois or New York or California or New Jersey or Maryland, you know, they're not able to go and take their permanent concealed handgun with them as they go and travel through those states. Or if you're a woman who's going to be driving across the country and may be worried about your car breaking down and possibly becoming a victim of some type of crime, you know, having states which ban you from being able to go and carry through them may make your whole journey much less safe than it would have been otherwise. And so now the debate right now, it looks like it'll pass fairly easily in the House. The Senate, though, Democrats have already promised to filibuster it. And since the Republicans only have 52 seats but will need 60 votes to get it through, they have to pick up 8 Democrats. And you've already had a number of Democrats who have voted for this at least twice when it's come up before, who have said now that they will no longer support this bill. Senator Mark Warner from Virginia, for example, has voted for this in the past, but now has said in a way that I don't really understand that he's not going to oppose it. The irony is that Virginia is a state that recognizes concealed carry permits from all 49 other states. And so,
of which, you know, he was once governor, by the way.
Exactly. And so he can't point to any problems that have occurred in Virginia by Virginia recognizing permits in all these other states, in all the states. You know, so why would it be that he's somehow concerned that other states will have a problem, even though his state has never seen such a problem?
Well, I gather the problem that a lot of people are claiming is that concealed handgun permit holders are dangerous. Isn't that pretty much the core of what they say?
Yeah, well, I mean, you see that with the New York Times. You see it with others. I think it's Warner hasn't been as explicit on that point, but I assume that's what he's getting at there. You know, and, you know, every 2 months, the New York Times will have an editorial by the editorial board there claiming that permit holders are dangerous. And what they cite time after time is work done by a place called the Violence Policy Center. Over the last 10 years, they claim that there are 969 deaths that have occurred by concealed carry permit holders. The largest group of that are suicides. And just give you an idea of the problems with their numbers, they claim that 40% of all these deaths have occurred in one state, Michigan, which if you talk to people in Michigan, they'd be surprised by. But 79 of the deaths, they say, are homicides, and almost 300 are suicides that have occurred in Michigan. And the way they get these numbers is, take the homicides first, because that's a more serious issue. The way they count it is if there's a news story, they'll include it. And if you are a law-abiding concealed carry permit holder and you use your gun, fire it in public to go and kill somebody, unless the police are completely sure about what happened, they're going to arrest you and investigate until they figure out for sure what happened. Well, if there's a news story, they'll count that as a bad event. Now, the Michigan State Police every year put out an annual report where they list by type of crime pending cases against permit holders as well as convictions. You may have a case that could be pending for 3 or 4 years. I mean, you look at something like the George Zimmerman case. That was pending for several years before it went to trial. Well, each year that a case is pending, they count that as a separate case. So you could have a case where you got a news story, it's pending for 3 years, and then the person is found not guilty by reason of having acted in justifiable self-defense, and they'll count that as four bad cases that had occurred.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not serious stuff. What you should do is only count the convictions. Makes no sense to count both pending cases each year and convictions and include the news story.
Right. Unless, of course, you want to stack the odds. We'll come back. We'll look at the suicide half of that equation in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-5-4-6-2-6. John Lott is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, their website, crimeresearch.org. And you were looking at the inaccurate information often put out there as regards concealed carry permit holders, and you mentioned the two categories, murder and suicide. What about the suicide portion?
Well, so, for example, about 300 suicides or so occurred, or said to have occurred in Michigan by permit holders. And what they do is they'll look at, they have the list of names, the state police has the list of names of the permit holders, and they go to the Department of Health and Human Services there in the state, and they have a list of people who commit suicide, and they just see whether the permit holders are on the list of people who commit suicide. The problem is, one, most suicides occur, the vast majority of suicides occur in the home, so a concealed carry permit's not even relevant. And they don't try to take out suicides that involved a gun versus other types of ways. So it's not even clear what the concealed carry permit has to do with most of those cases. But kind of more importantly, if you compare the suicide rate for permit holders, it's actually just 40% of the rate for adults generally in Michigan. And so, you know, the notion is somehow the fact that you've let people have a concealed carry permit has caused suicides, but the suicide rate is dramatically lower for permit holders, and that's even allowing for the fact that the vast majority of those suicides probably took place at home, and many of them, some of them must have taken place even without a gun.
Where do we stand right now as regards gun laws in general? What's the focus on Capitol Hill of this debate, that concealed carry circumstance?
Well, yeah, that's probably
going to be... And reciprocity?
Reciprocity will be the one big issue that's going to be coming up this time. I mean, the Trump administration, I understand, is trying to move on issues like gun-free zones for military bases, and they're also... Have undone some of the rules regarding Social Security that you and I have talked about before, which would have banned about 4.2 million Social Security recipients from being able to own guns, rules that were just put out at the very end of the Obama administration. But, you know, the reciprocity would be the big thing. At the state level, you've continued to see states moving in opposite directions on this. You've had some states that have been getting rid of gun-free zones, like at college campuses. Georgia just passed a law that would do that. And you've had a lot of states, from Texas to other places, that are making it easier by reducing the fees or other types of restrictions on people being able to carry. On the other hand, you have places like California, which for you to go and buy ammunition now, you're limited to buying 100 rounds at a time. You have to have a background check done, and apparently the rules are just going to be going into effect in a little bit, but it looks like it's going to cost about $70.
Yeah. All right. We're going to wrap on that note and stay on the line. We'll speak off air. Again, John Lott, his works include More Guns, Less Crime from University of Chicago Press, website crimeresearch.org. I'm Jim Bohannon. This is Westwood One.